This episode of Local Knowledge is presented by TaylorMade. The higher the inertia, the more forgiving the driver. Introducing the QI10 Max Driver from TaylorMade. Experience TaylorMade speed with the forgiveness of 10K inertia. Shop yours today at TaylorMadeGolf.com. There is a quote from Frank Stranahan, the great amateur golfer, that is so memorable and that I like so much for a few different reasons, that I agonized making this podcast about whether I should put it first or whether I should put it last. It's one of those deals where it could only go in one of those two places. It's so good that it's only a leadoff or a closer. It's not something you throw in the middle. And if I were more patient or I were a better storyteller, maybe I'd save it for the end, but I can't. This might go down as one of my favorite quotes from a golfer ever because it is so shocking. I might lose something by putting it up top. That something is context, which is what the rest of the episode will fill in. But what you have to know for now is that Cliff Roberts, big name in this episode, along with Frank Stranahan. Cliff Roberts was the co-founder with Bobby Jones of Augusta National, and he was the club's chairman from 1931 to 1976. This guy was Augusta. Everything about the place, both good and bad, was a reflection of him and an extension of him. And he was very good at making friends, but he made a lot of enemies along the way too, and one of them was Frank Stranahan. Stranahan was the son of a millionaire who became a highly accomplished golfer, highly accomplished athlete in general. He won two British amateurs. At the time, those were considered one of the four majors, and he was also known as kind of a playboy. He was muscular, he was good looking, he liked the ladies. He became famous outside of golf, he became a kind of celebrity. But make no mistake, this is the kind of consummate sportsman who, after he retired from professional golf, in his 40s, took up distance running, ran over 100 marathons. Go to the end of his life, 1997. He's over 70 years old. He wins the national bodybuilding competition. This guy is a fitness nut, ahead of his time there, a health nut. And Cliff Roberts and Frank Stranahan did not like each other. They had their share of run-ins. Roberts famously banned him from the Masters one year. We're going to get into all of this, but for the quote that I'm about to read you, what you have to know is that as Cliff Roberts aged, in his 80s, he had a stroke, and he got cancer, and he was basically debilitated. This was a very independent, impressive guy, and now his independence was gone. So in 1976, he stepped down from his role as chairman at Augusta, and a year later, on the morning of September 29, he got a haircut at the club barbershop, and then he made the choice to commit suicide by shooting himself in the head with a .38 caliber Smith & Wesson revolver on the banks of Ike's Pond, which is right on the par 3 course there at Augusta. And like so much of Roberts' life, the ending was dark. Frank Stranahan, though, he lived to age 90. He didn't pass away until 2013. And in 1998, the writer John Garrity from Sports Illustrated visited him to talk about his life, and especially about his expulsion from Augusta. And inevitably, the topic came to Cliff Roberts' death. And Stranahan, quoted by Garrity, said this, quote, "I wish I'd been there when he committed suicide. I would have rolled the son of a bitch into the water." End quote. And you can see why that quote is stuck with me. Once you hear it, you're not going to forget it. It's stark. It's, you know, it's dark. It's mean. It's funny. It's everything. And I don't think he was trying to be funny. That's the crazy thing. I don't think he was trying to be funny at all. I think there was some sincere bitterness there, but, you know, taken from a broad perspective, there is some dark comedy there. And that word dark, you're going to hear it over and over in this podcast. And remember, this is 21 years after Roberts' death. Stranahan himself was 76. Time clearly had not healed this particular wound. The story of Cliff Roberts and Frank Stranahan is on one hand a sideshow, but on another, it is a terrific look. Maybe in some ways the best look we get at the early years of Augusta and the shadowy way it operated and how things under Cliff Roberts were always a little off, always a little paranoid, always a little sinister. And here comes Stranahan, this good-looking rich kid, and he and Roberts are like oil and water. And the very fact that they're forced to interact means that we're going to get a peek under the veil. We're going to learn something not just about these two guys, but about the institution of Augusta itself as it existed before integration, before Martha Burke, before the modern era, where now they're inviting YouTube influencers to throw Nerf balls all over the course, right? Things have changed, but the origins are about as interesting and, here's that word again, dark as it gets. And nothing epitomizes that quite like the bizarre story of these two deeply strange men. I'm Shane Ryan. This is Local Knowledge. We are indebted, of course, to John Garrity for the quotes in the story that were just mentioned. But the primary source here, the big fun, is Kurt Sampson, the author who has written more than a dozen books about sports. The most famous is probably his Ben Hogan autobiography, but maybe the second most famous, and it was a New York Times bestseller, was called The Masters, with the subtitle Golf, Money, and Power in Augusta, Georgia. And it's a terrific read, and it pissed Augusta off at the time when it was published. They accused him of factual errors when it came out in 1998. And I'm not sure I've ever seen any of those errors confirmed, but one thing that they did in response was to grant another writer total access to the Augusta archives, and that resulted in a second book coming out not long after. And the idea, it seems, there was to counter the Kurt Sampson narrative. So that shows you the power that Sampson's book had, at least with Augusta National, who notoriously has been pretty sensitive to any criticism, to put it mildly. When I wrote my first book, I had a chapter on Augusta, and I asked Kurt Sampson in an interview I had with him, have you ever been credentialed again? By that point, it had been something like 15 years, and he laughed at me and he said, oh, Shane, no. So that is our primary source here, and it's a book I would have no hesitation in recommending if Augusta and its history is at all interesting to you. And, you know, this is just personal opinion, but I don't know how it couldn't be. I mean, the history of Augusta is completely fascinating. And the other source I thought that was really useful here was a story in Digest that you can find in our archives by a writer named Frank Hannigan, who was actually at one point the senior executive director of the USGA, but also a really good writer. And he wrote about Roberts in 1996 and, in fact, has my favorite physical description of him, which if you look up a picture of Roberts or you see him on YouTube or something like that, you immediately recognize how spot on it is and you wish you had written it yourself. Here's what Hannigan wrote, quote, Roberts was certainly not a dashing figure. He was button-faced and somber, American Gothic. His manner of speech was memorable only for its monotony. He wore a variation of the same blue suit every day and owned 24 identical rep ties. Life was too short, he said, to worry about what to wear. He was altogether unremarkable, except that, better than anyone else in golf, he understood power. How to acquire, use, and retain it. End quote. So, let's talk about Cliff Roberts. This guy is maybe the most fascinating man in the history of the business of golf. In our last episode, we did an OWGR podcast. We talked about Mark McCormack, the founder of MIG. He's another contender for that title. I think if you put together a bracket of these personalities, right, it's March, so we'll talk about brackets. They'd both be one seeds, and I would think they would crush the competition. They'd meet in the championships, Roberts versus McCormack. I don't know who would win, but inevitably they would be there. And everything you read about Roberts' life, there is a shadow over it. He didn't like to talk about his past. Sampson got plenty of information from an oral history that Roberts consented to later in his life, all about Dwight Eisenhower, the general, the president, Roberts' good friend. And the man who ran the interviews noticed that Roberts, who was older then, lived in New York mostly at the time, was very anxious to talk. He seemed lonely. And he actually gave the guy over 800 pages of material on Eisenhower. But he didn't talk much about Augusta, and he didn't talk almost at all about his childhood. And you can see why when you learn about it. Roberts was born on a farm in Iowa in 1894. His dad was in real estate. Seems like he dragged the family all over. His mom was a cousin of Francis Scott Key, of course, the author of the Star-Spangled Banner. Family moved to Kansas in 1910, and then they moved to Texas to the Gulf Coast. Roberts told the interviewer for this oral history that his father was, quote, always interested in seeing what was on the other side of the next hill, end quote. Roberts actually burned his own house down by accident when he was young. But the general thing here, And the big important part of his move to Texas was that for the first time, he was exposed to rich people. In his town, Palacios, there were oil men, rich real estate people, and all that. It was this boom time. A lot of people making a lot of big money. Now, darkness came in a big way in 1913. Roberts would have been in his late teens by then, and his mother, who was suffering from some illness that's not specified, she killed herself. The paper at the time wrote, quote, "The deceased had been a constant sufferer from ill health for more than a year. The death might have been an accident, but it is supposed to have been suicide for relief from continued suffering," end quote. She left a note to each of her children. Shortly after that, Cliff's father packed up and went back to Iowa, but Cliff stayed in Texas. He worked in a dry goods store after high school. And high school, by the way, is the last education he ever had. Then he opened his own clothing store to cater to the rich oil men who were everywhere. And he had seemingly a lot of success running his own store. Now, at this point, it's a foundational moment for Cliff Roberts. And a lot is constantly being read into it anytime you read something about him. And the next part is even more shocking. His father came back to Texas in 1921. Cliff actually supported him at that point. It seems like his father was struggling in business. And his dad also suffered from something called locomotor ataxia, which is a progressive disease of the central nervous system. You know, think something like ALS, maybe not as severe, but pretty severe, pretty bad. This one can be caused most commonly by syphilis or a stroke or alcohol abuse, things like that. And then at age 50, this man, Charles Roberts, he gets run over by a train. Train cut him in half. And it happened right after he had some sort of medical relapse, according to the newspaper account. And the obvious question you come to, is this another suicide tied to ill health? And the fact that Roberts, later in his life, Cliff Roberts, would do the same thing, although we should say much older than either of his parents, but the fact that he did it, you can imagine a lot is made of that. Potentially has two parents who killed themselves because of medical problems, and then he does the same thing. It's a very strange parallel. And not only that, but his behavior long before he ever gets sick is constantly analyzed. People like Samson and many others extrapolate and say, well, maybe the suicide of his parents explains why he behaved the way he did. You know, people called him vindictive and intimidating, a guy with not a ton of empathy. Well, maybe it was because of what he went through. And I personally would hesitate to armchair psychoanalyze like that. Clearly, it's going to have an impact of some sort. I'm not denying that. And obviously, there's something very interesting about the parallels in his own life. You know, the fact that he had a huge health scare. He decided, that's it. I'm not going to let the whole thing play out. I'm going to go out in my own terms. And another kind of interesting thing is that in a time where basically everybody was religious, especially in the South, he was never seen at church. Whether he was an atheist or not, nobody seemed to know. But this lack of religion, even sort of a public performance of religion, would have been very, very unusual. And again, people will speculate, did the death of his mother end his belief in God, if he ever had it? Then had to leave that one all open-ended. Roberts was not a man to talk about it. There are no other sources to figure that out. But what we can say definitively is that whatever else his childhood was like, there were some dark clouds over it. And he didn't even really stay close to his siblings. You know, the minute his dad left after his mother's death, he and his four brothers and sisters were never all together in the same room until 37 years later, apparently. And at this point in his life, Roberts throws himself into business. He's only 20, but he closes his clothing store and he hits the road as a suit salesman. Apparently that's more lucrative at this time, and he's incredibly good at it. And he also spent a lot of time with his mother's family in California. Remember, she came from money, a Francis Scott Key connection. The family had a big vineyard in Encinitas in California. And Robert spent a couple years there. He read biographies of famous people, became an ambulance driver in World War I. When the war was over, he came back to Texas, got into oil, as you might imagine he would. He leased land from farmers with the idea of releasing it to oil companies at a profit. And then he became a lease trader, right? So one step above that, he's overseeing a lot of the landmen, which he had been. And then in 1923, at this point, he's about 27 years old, he sold a bunch of mineral leases for $50,000. That was a lot of money then. And that was his big break. And he took that money to New York City. He got into the stock brokerage business with an outfit called Reynolds & Company. Took a bath in 1929 when the market crashed, but rebounded well and rebounded pretty quickly. Became extremely rich, started to run in high society, you know, became a very good bridge player, joined a country club, played golf. And he visited places with his friends on golf trips. One of those places he went to was Augusta, Georgia. Experience your drives in 10K with the all-new QI10 Max Driver from TaylorMade. QI10 Max Driver is TaylorMade's first driver to break the 10K inertia mark, delivering forgiveness and performance for all golfers. With QI10 Max, QI10, and QI10 LS, there's an option for every golfer to experience TaylorMade speed with straighter drives, even on off-center strikes. Shop yours today at TaylorMadeGolf.com. Now, the really important thing to know about Cliff Roberts, the fundamental engine of his success, I would call it, is that when this guy wants to make a friend, and the friend is a man and the friend is a rich man, he is very, very good at it. And he does want to. He wants powerful friends. The shame of it all, in some ways, is that you can't really tell how that worked on a moment-to-moment level, what he was like. You know, you could go to YouTube right now, as we said before. You could see videos of him doing award presentations at old Masters tournaments, but that's very stilted. It's on TV. It's not the same as seeing him in action on a person-to-person level. But it's clear that in action, he was charismatic. He could make himself useful. He could ingratiate himself into the lives of the powerful like almost nobody you've ever heard of. You can see the beginnings of that when he makes clothes for these oil men. That's his first job, right? He's serving the rich people. But it goes all the way to Dwight Eisenhower. You know, it's incredible. Cliff Roberts, when Eisenhower was president, he spent 120 nights at the White House. Eisenhower spent something like, just during his presidency, something like 30 days at Augusta. Roberts in the White House had his own room. He had his own robe. You know, Eisenhower is the most powerful guy on the planet, arguably, and Roberts built him his own house at Augusta, made him a lot of money. It's worth noting, his friendship with all these powerful men is always related to money they can make together. And Roberts would give him advice on everything, including matters of policy. It's really remarkable. And, you know, we're not going to talk about the Eisenhower relationship much at all in this, but flag that for yourself, that when I say he's good at making powerful friends, I mean, he made friends with the president. And he became best friends with him in some ways. So he must have had some kind of charm, or a very specific kind of charm that worked on these powerful people. One of those powerful men he met in 1925 was Bobby Jones. And he worked his magic, flattered his ego maybe, which in turn flattered Roberts' own ego. He liked to be in the orbit of people like Jones, became friends with him. They started a company together where they made a ton of money bottling Coca-Cola in South America. The company was called Joe Roberts, a combination of their last names. And together, they financed and built Augusta National. And here, finally, is where Roberts found his domain, his fiefdom. Here is where he would rule with an iron fist. And he would almost single-handedly build the allure of Augusta National, with the help of sports writers he courted, with the help of members. One of those sports writers, by the way, and the most important one, was somebody we've talked about before, Grantland Rice, who basically sang to his tune, sang to Roberts' tune. He was his personal little canary. I mean, that's a harsh thing to say, but that's exactly what the relationship was. He did everything he asked. He wrote everything he asked. As we'll see, he said everything he asked. And of course, a big ingredient in the Masters was television, which came in 1956 for the first time. And you get a sense of it. There is a network of rich friends and connections, and it's all, at this point in his life, geared toward building the aura of this club. And this aura is so strong and so powerful. You know, still today, it's remarkable. It's probably the best marketing job in the history of sports. And Robert spent money building the club. You know, he got a lot of money from other people, but it seems like he wanted to encourage the narrative that he might have lost money doing it, when the reality was he remained a very rich man. When he died, he was worth over $100 million, and that was before even looking at his properties. It's worth mentioning here, there is a lot of negative stuff about Roberts. Plenty of it. In fact, we had to cut a lot of it for this podcast. But he was a visionary. He was an incredibly smart guy. He's the one who discovered the property in Augusta, who saw it. You know, this was a nursery before he got there. He's the one who proposed its purchase to Jones. He saw it all playing out before him, and he was obsessive about first getting it up and running, and then second, overseeing and promoting and organizing the entire thing for basically his whole adult life. And there's a good detail which shows the power dynamic between him and Bobby Jones, which is that Roberts wanted from the beginning to call the tournament that they would hold there, the Masters. But Jones said, no, he overruled him. It's too pretentious. He didn't like it. So at first, it was called the Augusta National Invitation Tournament. And that stayed for a couple years. But Roberts kept at it. And in 1938, sure enough, it became the Masters. And in microcosm, that shows how it worked. Jones was the face, the beloved figure, and one of the most famous athletes in the country, and he had power in that sense. But when he disagreed with Roberts, Roberts was such an overwhelming figure, so powerful, so omnipresent, that part you can't underrate. The guy's always there, right? People like that tend to win a lot of arguments because they never go away. You know, he ran everything. Eventually, Roberts would get his way, even if it took time. And when Jones started to get sick with his spinal disease in 1947, even the appearance of any checks on Roberts' power were basically gone. It got to the point where, you know, and I want to be clear that Roberts was loyal to Jones. He kept him in the loop. But at one point, he told Jones that he didn't look well enough to be conducting the championship interviews on television. And Jones was very hurt about this, but he stopped. And it shows you that not only did Roberts have power, but he wasn't afraid to use it, even on Jones himself. Even if it was reluctant, he would do it. And actually, Jones's family really resented him for that. Apparently, there was also an incident where he may have refused Bobby Jones extra tickets at some point. But the upshot is that when Jones died, Roberts wasn't even invited to his funeral. And, of course, they had been great friends. So Augusta National opens in 1933. For the big opening, a bunch of New Yorkers travel down together in a train from Penn Station. And that part, that demographic part, has always been fascinating to me. The people of Augusta were New Yorkers. Not exclusively, but in large part. And there's a lot of racial stuff that we'll talk about and some that we won't talk about. Plainly put, Augusta was a racist place at the time. Now, it's up to you to go back and see, was it exceptionally racist? Probably not. It was probably no more racist than every single institution was racist at that time. Cliff Roberts, the same thing. He himself was an avowed racist. A quote attributed to him at one point was that as long as he was living, the players at Augusta would be white and the caddies would be black. And he almost, you know, made it. He almost made good on it. By 1975, he was forced to admit Lee Elder, and that was 2 years before he died. So he almost won his whole life, but not quite. But again, it's a judgment call, isn't it? It's by the standards of today, it's horrifying. But these guys were, for rich businessmen at the time, that racism was par for the course, no pun intended. It was standard. And so I think you can condemn them. It's not that you can't condemn them, but you also have to understand that they were not unusual. It wasn't like the Augusta was this racist sanctuary in Georgia. No, Georgia itself was racist, right? The entire American South was racist. The North was racist. Guys like Cliff Roberts were all pretty much fitting into that category at that time. Now, with that racism in Augusta, I think there's a wider perception today that it was a Southern thing. And that's the point I want to make. It was not the case there in the early days of Augusta. A lot of these guys were Northerners, either from New York or they had moved to New York. Think of Augusta then and for many years after as kind of a New York South, right? This little oasis for New Yorkers sitting there. And that's only to some degree. There were also a lot of what they called FOBs, which stood for Friends of Bob, Friends of Bobby Jones, who were your more typical Southern good old boys. So that demographic was there also, but it was also a lot of Northerners. So just keep that in mind. Anyway, they took this luxury train down from Penn Station. Among them was Grantland Rice, who helped organize the whole thing. Roberts kind of brought him in and said, you're going to be an integral part of this, which ensured good press for the club forever after. Because this writer, Grantland Rice, was larger than life. And it wasn't just about what he wrote. It was about when he wrote something, everybody else would write it too. So this was a very smart tactical decision by Cliff Roberts. And they had a great time that first day. You know, they all got drunk on corn whiskey. And at one point at the dinner down in the clubhouse, Grantland Rice stood up to speak. And he had this big prepared remark. He said that he had joined many clubs and a lot of them had gone broke. And the reason they went broke was there were too many meetings and too much bureaucracy. So, hey, everybody, I've got an idea. Why don't we let Bobby and Cliff just run this thing how they see fit and we don't even have to worry? Right? And everybody cheered and it was approved just by, you know, consensus. And voila, guess who had total power all of a sudden? And guess who had almost certainly put Grantland Rice up to that? Cliff Roberts. Now, we have to admit, whether it's, you know, racism or misogyny or anything like that, Augusta has always been dragged kicking and screaming into anything like the modern era. Again, we're not going to go too deep into it, but to give you an idea of what these guys thought of black people, one of the things they did for fun in the early days at a local hotel was to have these amateur boxing nights And the main act was to bring out some black kids, blindfold them, tie an arm behind their backs, and have them basically throw these hard one-handed punches at each other until only one was left standing. And again, this wasn't uncommon. This was part of the entertainment for these Augusta National members, but they didn't invent it. And so you see, it's just this case of superiority. They weren't going to have black members. They weren't going to have members, certainly, who were for women. Case closed. That's how it was done. And later in life, when he did the oral history on Eisenhower that we talked about, Cliff Roberts would have these shocking views on race, or shocking by today's standards. And he did fight very hard to keep black people out of the masters. So that's all documented. It is the reality of things. And it's obviously a subject worth longer treatment, but for our story today, that's about all we're going to do. Just know that it existed, that it was real, that it was sometimes horrifying and sometimes just banal standard operating procedure. And like we said about Roberts, it's not meant to let him off, but he is standard for his time. Not a special kind of racist, just a run-of-the-mill average racist. Hannigan put it this way, quote, "He thought that loyal blacks, including Augusta staff, should be cared for decently, so long as it was understood they were servants or entertainers." End quote. A couple other things about Roberts that were interesting. Just to give you a full sense of the man, he was married three times, had no kids. In fact, he didn't like kids. There's a story in Sampson's book that there was a prospective member who was on the verge of getting into Augusta, but he had five kids, and Roberts personally blocked him. He said something like, "If he's dumb enough to have five kids, he's too dumb to be a member here." And the other thing to note in passing, it's not going to affect this story very much either, but he was a terror to CBS. He was a terror to TV in general. Augusta always signed one-year deals, knowing CBS could be replaced at any moment, and they wanted reverence in that broadcast. He would write to CBS executives all the time, complaining about things like the announcers calling the little hills humps instead of mounds, or getting mad when CBS had a helicopter fly over the course for aerial shots. He's the guy who set the standard for just 4 minutes of commercials every hour at Augusta, so you can thank him for that. He's the one who booked the sponsors, even in some cases chose the announcers. He did everything. And there are funny moments, like when he tried to get Walter Cronkite, the famous newscaster, to introduce the tournament at Augusta, and CBS had to gently tell him that no, that wasn't going to happen. And he was obsessed with ratings. He wanted the Masters to be number one, and he was attuned to every possible slight or inconvenience when it came to competing with the other majors. I love this passage from Hannigan, who wrote, quote, "He once called me when I was a USGA bureaucrat to lament a PGA of America decision to play its PGA championship in February 1971, a desecration to him because it meant the Masters that 1 year would not be the year's first major. The call must have lasted 45 minutes, and I have still no idea why he called me, since A, there was nothing in the world I could do about it, and B, I couldn't have cared less." End quote. And you may have noticed that the Masters doesn't release attendance numbers. The reason is, according to Hannigan, because Roberts knew they wouldn't be number one. Other places can fit more people. So he kept those numbers mum. The man controlled everything down to the smallest detail. He's the one who paid Pinkertons to do crowd control rather than having marshals with their big quiet please signs that he hated. He lived at the club 4 months a year, and because he thought French fries were unhealthy, he wouldn't allow them to be on the menu. You get the point. A finger in every pie here. One really interesting tidbit that shows how stubborn he was, again, this is from Hannigan, at Digest, Joe Dye, the USGA executive who became the PGA Tour's first commissioner, told Roberts, that his practice of just having a little table with an umbrella for players to turn in their scorecards to an Augusta National member who would have been inexperienced with that kind of thing, he told him, "You're asking for trouble." In fact, Joe Dye said it burned them at the 1957 U.S. Women's Open when a player turned in a wrong scorecard. But Roberts wouldn't listen. He had his own ideas, and what happened? Well, in 1968, Roberto DiVincenzo turned in an incorrect scorecard, cost himself the tournament. Controversy that lives on today. A year later, Roberts had fixed it. He had built a whole facility, a whole scoring tent, and everything like that. But he wouldn't listen in time because he was so stubborn. And the funny thing is that in a press conference that year, one reporter said, "You know, what have you done to fix the situation with the scoring?" And Roberts kind of stared him down and said they weren't doing anything new. So even after addressing the problem, he didn't like to admit he screwed up. A lot of pride there, a lot of ego. And the last thing I'll say is that it should come as no surprise that the members he brought into Augusta were uniformly rich, wealthy, Fortune 500 executive types. They constantly added their wealth to the club, And Roberts would make use of that wealth. He'd use their private jets for favors, things like that. Hannigan tells the story of one year when the USGA president couldn't make it for the tournament. Roberts said, "You're coming." He used somebody's private jet to fly him in and out so he could be just at the awards ceremony and be seen on television. And for membership, he would also invite USGA presidents, executives, board members, any way to consolidate his power within the golf world, which is going to become important in the story we're going to tell about Stranahan. And what's funny about Roberts is that his charm extended to media members. And I say it's funny because today, as wonderful as the Masters is, as beautiful as it is, it's also the tournament where you can't get inside the ropes as a journalist, which makes following it tough. And what ends up happening is that journalists, quote unquote, cover the tournament from the admittedly very nice media center during competition days. And also, the Masters has a reputation, although this is diminishing with time, for being tough on media. There are a lot of rules, and if you screw one up, like having your phone on you and out, you know, during the when you're on the course or running on the grounds, you can get kicked out. It's happened before. Now, I should say this stuff seems to be abating, even in the last decade. You can notice it in the people who work in media relations, very nice people that I've worked with before. The sense of distance or intimidation that Roberts cultivated is not as prominent as it once was. But in the beginning, he was all about the journalists. He said, "Come to New York. The rest is on me. I'll get you down there by private plane. You'll have a house, car, drink, servants, everything you need." And he would hook them up. And you can imagine that the coverage was pretty positive after that, which, of course, was his goal. So take all of this, everything I've told you about Cliff Roberts. Like I said, he's an incredibly fascinating figure to me. Maybe it was overkill, all the details I just gave you, but there's stuff I had to leave out. You could write a novel on this man. So take it all, let the profile of him come together as a whole in your mind, and then answer this question. How would a guy like that react to Frank Stranahan? What if the highlight of your travels was the traveling itself? Picture this: American Airlines Admirals Club membership, VIP treatment, and more. And your vacation hasn't even started yet. With the Citi Advantage Executive World Elite MasterCard, you'll be looking forward to the journey as much as the destination. It's the only card with complimentary membership to American Airlines Admirals Club, so you can feel like you're on cloud nine before you're even in the air. And it rewards each purchase with American Airlines Advantage miles for your travels and loyalty points toward Advantage status. You can even earn up to 20,000 additional loyalty points after qualifying activities. So, a higher level of status and the high-end treatment that comes with it are more within your reach. Give yourself more to look forward to in every trip on American Airlines with the Citi Advantage Executive World Elite MasterCard. Apply today at citi.com/executive and earn 70,000 Advantage bonus miles after qualifying purchases. Citi Advantage. Travel on. Stranahan we can treat much more quickly, even though this too is an unbelievable figure. There's a way that some of these men take on the proportions of myth when you hear about them. Stranahan's not much different in that sense, although he's very different as a person from Cliff Roberts, on the surface anyway. He comes from Toledo, Ohio. His father, Robert Stranahan, made millions of dollars in the spark plug business. So right away, that sets him apart from Roberts, right? Everything Roberts did, he had to earn. His parents were struggling. His parents, at least one of them, probably both, seem to have committed suicide. But Stranahan is born on third base. He never has to kiss up to any rich people, right? He was handsome. He lifted weights. He was arrogant by all accounts. And people would call him a playboy. But again, I want to make something very clear, because when you hear that word playboy, a specific image comes to mind of somebody who, you know, takes life in a breezy way, jet sets around the world, is laughing, joking, has different women all the time, and generally not taking life very seriously because he doesn't have to. Well, that was not the case with Stranahan. Sure, he may have met a share of women, and if he did care about his looks, but this guy worked hard, both on the golf course and with his fitness, where he was legitimately a pioneer, at least in the golf world. And he was a very serious person. In fact, Jimmy DeMeritt, who in 1947 won the Masters while Stranahan finished second, DeMeritt would constantly tease him about how much he practiced, about his lifting weights, about his women. And DeMeritt was this guy who loved to joke. He wore bright colors. He had a big personality. And I love this quote from Stranahan later in life. It shows what he was like. He was asked about DeMeritt, and he said, quote, "He was like a clown with a tam." Tam is that Scottish hat. and all the colors. Yeah, Jimmy kidded with me all the time, but I don't care for people who are always joking. I prefer someone who makes a lot of enemies and a lot of friends. End quote. This guy was no joke. Now, you can imagine there was a ton of resentment from other pros, and not just because of his looks or his muscles, but because he didn't have to turn pro. His dad's money meant he could stay an amateur, and it gave him all kinds of privileges right from the time he was 17. His father arranged for Byron Nelson to give him a series of lessons, because Nelson was the pro at Inverness and Toledo. And this is funny. Here's how Nelson described those lessons in his autobiography. "Well, I soon found out that this young man wouldn't listen to anything I had to say. He just wanted me to watch him hit balls, and he wouldn't change anything or take any of my suggestions seriously." And then Sampson in his book writes, "After a few weeks of this, Byron quit as his instructor, telling the teenager, 'You're wasting my time and your father's money.' The father intervened, a truce was reached, and Frank attended to the pro's advice a little more in subsequent lessons. He worked extremely hard, and his game advanced impressively. But it kept being a contentious relationship. Stranahan would always ask Nelson to play at Inverness. Nelson would say no, and one day Stranahan goes up to him and gets fed up and says, 'It's because you're scared I'll beat you.' So Nelson said, 'I'll play you and your two friends. You can play best ball together.' And Nelson went out and shot a 63, beat all three rich kids, and then he wrote in his autobiography, 'Frankie never bothered me again.'" End quote. But he kept practicing, Stranahan did. Apparently, nobody practiced more than this guy. He was up there with Ben Hogan in that regard. He went all over the world to play. He won a lot of amateur events everywhere, played on Walker Cup teams, and he became pretty famous in the sports world, became a known figure in the American public. He was on the road all the time. He'd be out for as much as 45 weeks a year. In 1945, he won the Durham Open, a sort of early PGA Tour event, as an amateur. Won two more tour events in 1946, including the Fort Worth Invitational, where this time he beat Nelson, along with Ben Hogan, on their own course. In 1947, he won the Lo-Am at the Masters, did the same at the Open Championship, finished tied for second in both of those. 1948 and 50, he wins the British Amateur. 1950, he comes in second at the USAM, lost that one in extra holes in the final. In the end, he won more than 50 amateur titles. So he was the real deal, and despite his reputation, a very serious guy who was very serious about his game. In fact, it seems like he only had one joke in his entire repertoire, and it was that he would fill his suitcases with barbells because he liked to lift weights on the road, and he'd get a kick out of watching bellhops everywhere struggle to carry them when he got to a new hotel. That was his running gag. That year, 1947, Stranahan was clutch in the final round of the Masters. Shot a 68, which was the lowest score of the day, but Demerit, who had decided to wear canary yellow top to bottom, again, he loved the spotlight, shot a 71, and his lead was big enough that he won by two shots. So, 1948 comes. Stranahan arrives at the Masters at the top of his game, finished second a year earlier. He's 25 years old. He's in his prime, pulls up in his Cadillac. Everybody's gawking at him. It's kind of hard now to understand his celebrity, but he was a big draw at these events. Here's how Sampson put it briefly. He said, quote, "The tour commissioner understood that Frank was a draw, a rich kid. As everybody knew, his father founded Champion Spark Plugs. Good looking. Didn't take a dime in prize money. Long hitter, sharp dresser." End quote. And Sampson also wrote, quote, "He was also the athlete many people loved to hate." I got that impression reading Sampson's descriptions of him and reading other accounts that if he played in the modern era, there'd be a lot of people who hated this guy. I don't even know if there's a comparison to make there. It's somebody who's rich and entitled and everything like that. I don't know if there's a good comp there, but I think people would have something to say about Frank Stranahan if he was a golfer today. Sampson quotes a writer named Tom Styler, who even at the time writes, quote, "As a golfer, Stranahan is the most egocentric, monomaniacal character who ever swung a niblick. Frankie walks ramrod straight, taking long, deliberate steps, somewhere between a strut and a swagger. His solid-colored polo shirts fit him as tight as Mabel's girdle." End quote. That was in Collier's, by the way, and because of that article, Stranahan's dad canceled $300,000 in advertising with them. So, 1948, Stranahan gets to Augusta, checks in his hotel, goes to play a practice round, and the pro, Ed Dudley, who also happened to be president of the PGA, says to him, and this is according to Stranahan, that he's going to be thrown off the grounds this week. And he warns him, don't hit two practice balls into the green. Don't do it. Apparently, that's a rule he broke the year before, and now they were watching him. Garrity, in his piece, he quotes Stranahan saying, the pro told me they would do anything to get me out of the tournament. So he gets out in the course, and Marion Luke, the superintendent, comes out, warns him. He's the second person. Warns him against practice balls. Don't hit two into the green. Obviously, these guys have been prepped, right? It's clear that Stranahan was, if not a target, at least a suspect. And Marion Luke apparently got pretty confrontational with him. Now, according to Stranahan, who's playing alone, was just a caddy, he followed the rule. Going to be up to you who you want to believe here. There's no camera footage, of course. But he says he didn't hit into the green with multiple balls. When he used multiple balls, it was on the green, which was allowed. You could putt from a few different places. That was okay. But at one point, Marion Luke comes back. He says, you hit two balls into the green. Stranahan denies it. They call each other sons of bitches. Stranahan calls him ridiculous. Sampson writes that Luke runs off to report him. And when Stranahan gets to the eighth green, there's a delegation of Augusta members waiting for him. And they tell him, your invitation has been withdrawn. Please leave the golf course. Now, Stranahan told that to Sampson. When Stranahan talked to Garrity, though, he said that Roberts himself kicked him out. Either way, this was unbelievably drastic. Nobody could believe it happened. Gene Sarazen was one of the people who was stunned when he heard. And Stranahan, for one of the first times in his life, he was dumbfounded too. He called his dad. He called his friend Tommy Armour, obviously very influential. They both told him, go to Bobby Jones. He's going to help you. He'll understand. Here's what Garrity writes happened next. Quote, but Jones dodged Stranahan for 2 days, and when they finally met on Wednesday, the great man threw up his hands. Sorry, Frank, Cliff runs the tournament. I never had a chance to give my side of the story, Stranahan says. I never had much respect for Bobby Jones after that. End quote. Now, what's interesting is that Stranahan didn't leave. He didn't leave Augusta. He bought tickets for the tournament. He stayed. He apparently behaved very well. And people respected him a lot for how he took it, even after Jones turned him down and Roberts said there would be no hearing. The very fact that he remained there, that he conducted himself with apparent grace in this bizarre situation, ended up doing more for his reputation than anything before had. But it's also true that nobody stood up for him. No players, nobody in the professional golf bureaucracy. Cliff Roberts had too much power. Everybody was afraid of him, and they knew that if something like this happened, it wasn't happening without Cliff Roberts knowing. In fact, with his incredible attention to every last detail and his, you know, authoritarian streak, Roberts was probably behind it. That was a safe bet. Even if it was the pro warning him and the superintendent catching him and a group of members telling him to leave the property, you'd have to think that Roberts was the guy orchestrating everything. And nobody crossed him. Nobody stood up for Stranahan. And again, who was going to? The PGA president was Augusta's pro. Might have been in on it. The USGA president was an Augusta member. This is why Roberts did that. This is why he brought those people to him, situations like this, so that when he acted, there was nobody to oppose him. Even with the press, Roberts brought in, you know, the main guy from Atlanta, asked him to downplay it. The word got out, and the press mostly downplayed it. We call that power, and he exercised it here in a pretty thorough way. Still, it's remarkable. Imagine today, someone who finished second the year before, one of the most famous players in the world, being banned from the Masters for something like that, hitting two balls onto a green. This was a major shock, and it cheapened all of them, including Bobby Jones, and they knew they'd screwed up. I like what Sampson wrote about it. Quote, when Roberts booted Stranahan from the Masters, he dominated not only one player, the least little dictator might do that, Cliff also cowed the entire field, the golf organizations, the press, and Bob Jones. In a gym or a boxing ring, Frank could have crushed him like a bug. At Augusta National, however, Roberts kicked sand into the muscle man's face. But Cliff kicked only with the full faith and cooperation of the other members. When they decided to stonewall inquiries into the conflict, no one broke the silence, revealing both the personality of Augusta National's leaders and the membership's remarkable loyalty to the office of the chairman, and perhaps to the chairman himself. The decision to boot Stranahan without a trial and then to not talk about it also revealed a breathtaking institutional arrogance. And Sampson does not spare Bobby Jones. He continues, Jones avoided the conflict and fell in step with the others. He supported an indefensible course of action. End quote. Now, what you're probably asking, what anybody in their right minds would ask, is why did this really happen? Was it really because he had, you know, hit a few golf balls into the green a year before and maybe did it again during a practice round? Considering Stranahan's arrogance and Roberts's vindictiveness, it's not impossible that that is the full extent of the story. That's not at all impossible. But there's something else that's intriguing here. In 1948, Golf World wrote about a rumor that, quote, Frankie, that's Stranahan, had dated a blonde who was palsy with a club member, that this made said member jealous, and the greenkeeper incident presented an opportunity to chastise Stranahan for his winning ways with the ladies, end quote. The rumor went further. The member, according to this rumor, was Cliff Roberts, and the blonde woman was his secretary. Now, nobody would talk about this. I think I've used the word omerta plenty of times before in regards to professional golf. The word refers to the code of silence in places like the mafia. Well, Augusta had their own omerta. They observed it closely and nobody broke ranks. But what's more astonishing is that Stranahan never did either. He told Sampson he didn't want to go into it. He told Garrity the same. Quote, I've heard a lot of stories, but I'm not going to tell you those. End quote. And this was an old man. To his dying day, he never said a word about it. But he would say to Sampson that he didn't think it was just about hitting balls into a green. So, take that for what you will. At this point, both men have passed. We're probably never going to know what really happened there. But I think it's an amazing confluence of big, controversial personalities meeting in this really unique, strange way that says so much about both of them, but also about Augusta, because Augusta was Cliff Roberts. And Stranahan probably had so much that Roberts coveted, his looks, but more than that, the money. Roberts was a hero worshiper, but he was a self-made man. And here was a guy who was a prefabricated hero. Not beloved, but he had money and he had his appearance. And maybe if you believe the rumors, he could come in and just instantly charm the secretary that maybe Roberts had liked or another member had been involved with. Who knows? But again, Stranahan represents a lot of things that Roberts would covet. And to get him back, he used the thing that he had that Stranahan didn't, which was power in this specific time and place. And it was a power he had built, and it was a power he knew how to wield. Stranahan came back the next year, even wrote an apology letter to Jones. In a funny twist, they had this Calcutta where the members buy players, and turns out that Cliff Roberts bought Stranahan the next year. But Stranahan played a few more times. He never finished better than T14. He turned pro in 1954 after losing to Arnold Palmer in the USAM, won the Los Angeles Open as his biggest event of his career a few years later, continued to lift weights, was pretty ahead of his time in that way, and eventually he retired from golf. Kept up with his fitness, right? We said he was a marathon runner. He had tough moments in the rest of his life, some really tough ones. His father passed from cancer. His son died at age 11 from cancer. His wife died from cancer when she was 45. And he had another son die at age 19 from a drug overdose. When Sampson visited him when he was 75, he wore a black Speedo and a tight black tank top from Gold's Gym. His house had no furniture beyond a bed and a small kitchen table. There were free weights everywhere, scrapbooks, photographs all over the floor. Sampson described him as never slouching, compared his presence to the actor Patrick Stewart. And his routine is really something. Every morning, he would wake up at 3:30 a.m. to watch a biography he taped on the History Channel or A&E the night before. He'd be working out the whole time he was watching. He'd drink carrot juice, eat a raw sweet potato, eat six eggs. And he fasted one day a week, and then for 10 consecutive days, four times a year. His entire goal, the thing he thought about the most, was to live at least to 120 years. He thought he might be able to make it to 140. And he was gruff with Sampson. Said things to him like, I'm into longevity. You will be too, but by then it'll be too late. Sampson wondered jokingly, you know, if he was going to get there to 120 by drinking a lot of milk. And Stranahan shot back, I think milk is the worst food in the whole world, so I can see you don't know a lot about nutrition. The guy didn't like doctors. He didn't like medicine. And then 3 years later, on his 78th birthday, he deadlifted 265 pounds. So, Pretty impressive old guy, and you can kind of, you probably met old people like that, right? Those gruff sort of opinionated old guys, and he was one of them. In the end, he fell short of his goal by 30 years. He lived to age 90. passed away in West Palm Beach after what was described as a short illness. Apparently he worked out at his gym until shortly before his death, so whatever took him seemed to hit him quickly, and it was over before long. So this is kind of a strange guy, but true to himself, right until the end, and you have to respect what can only be described as a monk-like devotion to living his life, whether that was fitness or athletics or anything. You get the sense with Stranahan that even if he didn't have a rich father, he would have had a remarkable life in some way. And that's what I like about this story, these two incredibly unique, larger-than-life people clashing at this one point in time. And we've already talked about the rest of Cliff Roberts' life, but there's one more detail that astounds me. After he died, he had all this money, this massive estate, and half of it went to his third wife, but the other half, most of it went to charities, and most of the charities were about limiting population control. He left a ton of money, millions of dollars, to Planned Parenthood, for instance, because abortion to him was a good idea because it would help this population problem. And Sampson writes that one of his core beliefs was that, quote, overpopulation would be the death of us all. So his last act is to try to help control the number of people in the world by donating tens of millions of dollars to those kinds of charities. I mean, right up until his death, this is just kind of insane. I mean, these details about both of these guys. And you go back to that quote from Stranahan talking about Roberts' suicide. You know, I would have rolled the son of a bitch into the water if I were there. And you get it. There's no way these two personalities could get along. And if you put them in the same place, it was always inevitable that they were going to clash. But the more you learn and the more you read, boy, you can't help but think, I think these two strange, fascinating men have a lot more in common than either one of them would ever have admitted. Local Knowledge is produced by Greg Gottfried, with editorial guidance from Sam Weinman. Our music for today's episode was called Saturday Afternoon by Lobo Loco. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to Local Knowledge wherever you get your podcasts, and check out Golf Digest's other podcasts, The Loop and Golf IQ. If you're a Golf Digest Plus subscriber, try out our new exclusive newsletters, Low Net, Golf IQ, and Undercover Pro. Thanks very much, and have a great day.